Okay then, brethren, as you know already, this is a special day. It's the final day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which means that pretty much we can soon get back to all those things we've been missing. Delicious toast, marmalade, muffins, and so on. And I think we know that plenty of people around us at the moment are on holiday. Especially here in the UK, at least, they're on holiday today, because it's the Easter holidays. But hardly anyone is keeping this day as a holy day. And yet, we all know that today is an appointed time according to the Creator God, and is largely ignored by the world. Let's open our Bibles at Leviticus 23 and read some fairly well-known passages. Leviticus 23, we'll begin in verses 1 and 2. And here we read, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, The feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Now, the word feasts there is a Hebrew word, moed or moedim, meaning appointed times. These are the appointed times of whom? Well, of Jehovah God. He says, these are my feasts, these are my appointed times. And today we'll see is one of them. And yet all around us, the world is on holiday. Easter holidays with eggs and bunny rabbits and fertility symbols. But God's holy day is almost entirely ignored. If only people would believe and practice this single verse, verse 2. Let's drop down to verses 4 to 8. "These are the feasts, the appointed times of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times." That's the same word, moed. "On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread." And we started this last Tuesday. Feast here actually being a festival, a banquet, not an appointed time. Verse 7, "On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it, but you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. And notice, the seventh day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it." And today is the seventh day, the final day of the 7 days of unleavened bread. And we've said before, you know, these appointed times of God are not random. It didn't just happen by accident. God selected these dates and the timing, and he gave them to us for our benefit. The feast days are annual reminders of key parts of God's plan for you and for me. Now, in the past 7 days, we've tried to avoid leaven, and any leaven we found we put out, put away, which pictures the putting out, the putting away of sin and false teaching. Also, we've eaten unleavened bread for those 7 days, picturing, in a sense, that we are living right as we make our way to the Promised Land. And we often look back to the first Passover, the original ancient Exodus of Israel, because that was an absolutely major event in world history. Nothing like it before. It affected millions of people, multiple nations across the Middle East. It brought down at least one world empire. It was a huge event. And there are many details recorded in Scripture about Israel's journey from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land. And I think we probably all agree there are many, many lessons that you and I can learn from their experiences. And I think this is a good time of year to go over some of those key lessons we can learn from ancient Israel and their journeys. So I've titled today's message, Adventurers in the Wilderness. Adventurers in the Wilderness.
I haven't got that.
Sounds good. So let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and read verses 1 through 13. Because that tells us some things we need to know as we begin this review. 1 Corinthians 10, beginning in verse 1. We all like adventures, an adventure story. I like reading about the adventures of Israel as they passed from Egypt towards the Promised Land. Some great stories, but there are lessons in these stories. So let's see what the lessons are and if they're relevant to us. Or maybe it's just history. No more than that. Just a record of what took place for the benefit of academic historians. Yes or no? Well, let's see what Paul says. Verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So here's ancient Israel on their way out of Egypt. Notice several times it refers to all of them. They all did this, they all did this, they all did this. All of them. Verse 5, but, oops, a problem. All, but. With most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. I guess the adventures didn't end too well then. For, well, it says most of them. And of course, we actually know the numbers that of the adults, perhaps as many as 2 million or something, who left Egypt, only two arrived at the Promised Land. So when it says with most of them, God was not well pleased, that's surely true. But of course, that's ancient history. That's not, and it's the history of the Israelites, or some people simply say, well, the Jews. So not relevant to us New Testament believers, is it? I mean, this is ancient stuff. This is thousands of years ago. Well, what possible connection could this have to a New Testament believer? Surely none. Well, verse 6, now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So wait a minute. The Apostle Paul says these are examples for us. There are examples. So that we, New Testament believers, shouldn't do the foolish things that they did. So he says, don't lust, don't crave after evil things. Verse 7, do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We'll see later exactly how they played. But Paul says, don't you become idolaters the way they did. Verse 8, nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. So is this relevant to believers today? Well, Paul says here in verse 8, nor let us believers commit sexual immorality as they did. Verse 9, nor let us tempt or provoke Christ as some of them also tempted. And what happened to them? They were destroyed by serpents. So Paul says, don't let us provoke the Lord Jesus. Verse 10, nor murmur, meaning grumble and complain, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. And Paul's applying it to his audience. Verse 11, now all these things happened to them purely for a historical record. No. All these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. So they were written down for you. They were written down for me. The stories of the adventures of Israel in the wilderness were written down for our benefit as New Testament believers. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Do not be complacent. Do not be lazy. On the other hand, Paul brings out here in the next verse that we should be confident. We shouldn't be overly concerned, because no temptation or test or trial has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful. Now we'll see in a few moments that Israel never understood that God was faithful. They never grasped that truth. But we can. God is faithful. He is faithful. God is faithful. God is faithful. If there's one thing God is faithful. He is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted or tried beyond what you are able, but with the temptation which will come, will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. So, there are lots of good examples, actually, to be more accurate, lots of bad examples in the adventures in the wilderness, but they're written down for our admonition, our instruction, so let's be instructed. Let's turn to Numbers 14 and pick up in verse 19. Numbers 14. And pick up in verse 19. And we'll read through verse 24. So they'd been bad, and God had threatened to annihilate the entire nation, and Moses had interceded and asked God to please forgive them this one more time. Let's pick up in verse 19. Pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, says Moses, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until now. Then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word. But truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have put me to the test now these 10 times, and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him, and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. And also Joshua was included. But notice in verse 22, God talking to Moses says, these people who have seen my majesty, seen my glory, seen all the signs I've done for them, and notice they've put me to the test now these 10 times. They'd provoked God 10 times. Well, you know what? It's probably not a good idea to provoke God once, I would have thought. Do you think it's a good idea to provoke God once? Well, what about 10 times? This is madness. Some people say that 10 is just a sort of rough number and it means a lot of times. Well, I think we can find 10 occasions specifically which we can look at and learn the lessons. These are the adventures of Israel in the wilderness. And 10 times they provoked God, and this was one time too many, as we'll see as we go. So let's look at the first provocation, the first test of God. Exodus chapter 14. So let's turn to Exodus 14. Right back pretty much at the beginning of the story, or just after the Passover. Exodus 14, beginning in verse 5. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" Which to me sounds like the most stupid of questions. You know, your nation is a ruin. It's destroyed. You know, everything that grew has been blasted by hailstones and fire and chewed up by the locusts. The firstborn are all dead, the people and the beasts. Your nation is a wreck, and you're saying, why did we let them go? Obviously, some insanity there. So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. They're going to chase after Israel. Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness before they realized they were being chased, of course. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and also his army. It wasn't just 600 chariots, it was all the cavalry plus all the army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-hahiroth before Baal-zephon. And Josephus, the Jewish historian, says that there were 200,000 soldiers in the army, plus 50,000 cavalry. Now, don't know where he got those numbers, but probably it was a pretty sizable military force heading out after a slave people. Verse 10, and when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, let's wait and see God's wonderful deliverance, because we know God's taking us to the promised land. We've seen his mighty works so far. Let us stand and watch how he knocks spots out of the Egyptians. Well, no. They said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Where, of course, they've been a slave people. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone, that we may be slaves and happy? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in this wilderness. Now, what's the problem here? You know, God's performed 10 mighty miracles and signs in Egypt, and here they are, and what are they doing? Well, they're not trusting God. They're bellyaching already. They want to go back to the safety of our former life in slavery? Really? And so what sort of lessons can we see here? Well, you know, some of them would be that when we try to leave or initially leave our former way of life, our bondage to Satan, perhaps bondage to our bad habits, we get chased sometimes. We get pursued. People come after us. Former friends come after us. Our bad habits track us down. We find sometimes that I thought it was going to be a piece of cake going God's way, but look at all the troubles surrounding me. Oh, wish I'd never been called. I wish I was still back with my former life and my former buddies. You know, it needs faith not to be moved by what we see around us. If we're going God's way, as these people were, then let's have some faith in God's faithfulness, which, of course, Paul told us in 1 Corinthians 10. God is faithful. Who will make a way of escape? Which, of course, he does exactly here. So these people are, when you can say it was early, yeah, they've only just left Egypt a few days before. They're still very physical, very carnal. And so they get scared quickly. Yeah, okay, maybe. Verse 13. Let's see what happens. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." I wonder if we really believe that in our case. The Lord will fight for us, and we can be at peace. And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it," of course, as you do. You can look at YouTube and see how you can part the Red Sea, Moses. Well, this is new stuff. "And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea, and I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. The pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. Verse 21, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left." And the Egyptians pursued. Not sure I'd have done that if I'd been an Egyptian. And I thought probably, into the sea, no way. So the Egyptians pursued. Perhaps they were chased by their captains and generals and all that lot. "And went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, his horsemen, and presumably his foot soldiers too. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. He took off their chariot wheels, so they drove with difficulty." Right, sounds logical. You know, if you're driving a four-wheeled automobile and all the wheels come off, it's tricky, isn't it, to steer particularly well with no wheels. So at this point, you've got to be thinking, this is a bad place to be if you're an Egyptian soldier. And the Egyptian said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord Jehovah fights for them against the Egyptians." Good thinking, boys, but too late. "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, and the waters, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and then the waters returned, and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So Jehovah saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. Notice here, Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. I imagine quite a number probably sank out of sight with all their armour and so on, but obviously quite a number just floated along, probably lots of dead horses floating, dead soldiers floating, and some on the seashore. Thus Israel, notice, saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Well, at least it's a good outcome, right? Because they saw dead bodies piled up everywhere. And they feared God and believed God. Well, we got there eventually. They're now converted. Salvation is upon them. The light has dawned. And for you and me, well, there's a few lessons there. Obviously, even the most impossible and insurmountable of obstacles in front of you and me won't stop God. God's well able to help you and me overcome anything. But we're saying here that, Israel, verse 30, saw the Egyptians dead. Verse 31, saw the great work. So clearly, they're now fully converted. Any little doubts they had when they left their homes in Goshen have now evaporated because they've got it. The penny's dropped, right? Wrong. Let's look at the second provocation, which takes us only into the next chapter. And most of the next chapter is actually a song of rejoicing that they sang. So barely is the song finished echoing in the mountains, and we get to verse 22. So Exodus 15, verses 22 to 26. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went a whole 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. So how long is this? 3 days? Is that like 72 hours? Is that like a blink? And don't forget, they've just walked through the Red Sea on dry land. They've seen the Egyptian armies and cavalry sort of drowned. They just witnessed a few days earlier the complete destruction of the Egyptian empire with 10 great plagues. They've seen all of that. Now, 3 days in, what happens? Now, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Now, it says murmured. That's like grumbled, complained. You might remember back in 1 Corinthians 10, it says about us, don't let us murmur as they murmured. Because what does it mean to murmur? It means they don't see God. They have no eyes on God. They're walking by sight. Definitely not by faith. There's no evidence about it. Well, God just brought us through the Red Sea and performed unbelievable miracles like 70 hours ago. I wonder how he'll bring water to us here. How will he make us be able to drink these waters? I wonder if that's beyond God's power. None of that. Murmured, complained, and I think these guys and gals were professionals.
University degree in that.
If there's one thing they could do well, it's grumbling. And they grumbled. And you and I, you know what? We've got to be careful. There's lots of things to grumble about. I'm not denying that. If you look around you, people and systems and the environment and circumstances and the world and politicians and celebrities, Your own family. There's plenty you can grumble about. I don't think grumbling goes down too well up on high. Anyway, solution, verse 25. So Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. And there he made a statute and an ordinance for them. And there he tested them and said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God, if you diligently, and if you do what is right in his sight, grumbling isn't one of those, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. Quite an offer to have God as your healer, rather than relying on incompetent and arrogant others. But here, the waters are made sweet and everybody's happy. So that's it. You know, thankfully, any lingering doubts have been now, you know, satisfied. God can make waters sweet, even the desert. We're happy, Moses. Let's move on now. Let's get to the promised land and enjoy it. Well, the third provocation is in the next chapter. In fact, the next chapter is three provocations. So numbers 3, 4, and 5 are all in the next few verses. Let's read verses 1 to 5. So third provocation, Exodus 16, starting verse 1. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. This sound like men and women of faith? This sound like a good idea to say we wish God had killed us back in Egypt? Or that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat, when we had bread to the full? For you, Moses and Aaron, have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So they're looking back to the flesh pots of Egypt. Do you remember those days in McDonald's and Goshen? Do you remember the Burger King there down by the Nile? Do you remember the cheeseburgers, the French fries? Do you remember the ice cream sundaes? Oh, to be back as a slave in Egypt. I mean, it's almost like, are they making this up?
Pathetic.
And are you going to kill us out here? You know, all they're thinking about is their bellies. They are. These people are materially minded people. They've got no appetite, it seems, for discomfort. No understanding about the need occasionally to sacrifice. Surely already by now they could think, you know what? We can walk by faith because our God keeps delivering us. I'm sure he'll do it here. But no, just grumble, 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 and accuse God and Moses of trying to kill them. Wow. Well, thankfully God, you know, comes around and assists, verses 4 and 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. This is going to be manna. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. It shall be in the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in. It shall be twice as much as they gather daily. So we know the story here. They provoke God, but God's being merciful still. Okay, I'm going to feed them this miracle called manna. It'll be provided 6 days, and it will sort of preserve itself on the seventh day, on my Sabbath. So that should be the end of the problem, shouldn't it? Well, let's look at the fourth test, the fourth provocation. Exodus 16, and let's read verses 16 to 20. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded, says Moses, let every man gather it, talking of the manna, according to each one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons, let each man take for those who are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so and gathered some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing over, he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. And Moses said, so here's an important part, you know, of the instruction, and surely by now they know God's with them, and surely they realize this is a miracle. You're out in the wilderness. There are no Kentucky Fried Chickens, right? There are no Denny's. There are no McDonald's. But God's going to provide for them every single day, as it turns out, for several decades. And Moses said, let no one leave any of it till morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, but some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank, sort of decayed very quickly, and Moses was angry with them. So what's the problem here? It's quite simple. Gather. Don't leave any. Don't try and keep any for tomorrow, because there'll be some tomorrow. God will provide for you every day. So you know what the problem is. They don't trust God. They're gathering as much as they can, and they're putting it away and hiding it in their tents and their homes, because how can you trust Jehovah God to do it tomorrow? We know he's done it today, but you know, with God, you just never know what he's going to do. Maybe he'll feed you today. He'll starve you tomorrow. So no trust. No faith. Do it yourself. Figure out your own way to maximize your possessions. Never find yourself having to rely on God. Do we ever do that? Well, I don't want to rely on God. I think I need to make sure I've got, you know, plenty stored up for a rainy day. I'm not sure God will come through. You know, God wants me to maximize and store up for a rainy day. That's one of his proverbs. Okay, the fifth test is just a few verses later. Fifth provocation, when they really start. I think God's probably starting to get more and more agitated, because they don't seem to be learning any lessons here about his faithfulness, his provision, his goodness, his clear intention to bring them to the promised land. So verses 23 to 30. Then Moses said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until the morning. Well, that's different. You're not supposed to do that other days. But here's different, because the Sabbath is special. It's the holy Sabbath to the Lord. So they laid up till morning as Moses commanded, and, wow, it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Thanks for that, at least. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. And this way God identifies the Sabbath, shows that it's holy to him. He miraculously preserves the manna overnight. And of course there's none on the Sabbath, because you can't go out working then. Well, unless you're an Israelite. Verse 27, now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but obviously they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Well, you know, getting out to gather when you're being told don't, you can see manna as a miracle. It's just plain disobedience. You know, right under God's nose. You know, God holds the Sabbath dearly. It reminds him of his creation. It's his holy Sabbath, says so there. And of course, what are the lessons for us? Well, you know, one of them would be keep the Sabbath holy. Don't become casual over the Sabbath day. You know, I've said in the past, you know, we often use phrases like, I keep the Sabbath. You know, those people over there are Sunday keepers, but I keep the Sabbath. Well, I think we know what that means, but it's an incomplete statement to say, I keep the Sabbath. What do you mean you keep the Sabbath? Because the Bible says, keep the Sabbath holy. So we may say, well, I keep the Sabbath, meaning I don't go out to work or I don't go out shopping. But actually, God's instructions are, keep the Sabbath holy. Now, if we put that word into our sentences, I keep the Sabbath holy. They keep Sundays, but I keep the Sabbath holy. I keep the holy Sabbath holy. Is that what we do? Well, there's a challenge for us. Okay, on to the sixth provocation. And you think, surely by now, even the dumbest has got the message. Right? God is reliable, dependable, trustworthy, faithful. He delivers. He's on our side. Well, off to Exodus 17. And let's read verses 1 to 7. So Exodus 17. And by the way, you can see this is piling up chapter by chapter. Exodus 17, we're only something like, you know, 5 or 6 weeks out from Egypt. We're already up to the sixth provocation in about 6 weeks. So they're not hanging about, these guys and gals, are they? They're provoking God every waking hour of the day almost. So here we are in chapter 17, verse 1. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink, which shouldn't, you would have thought, by now be a problem. But it was. Therefore, the people contended with Moses. Well, that means to argue. That means to squabble, to fight. The people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt or provoke the Lord? Because Moses understands that God will provide. These people just do not seem to get that. The people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured. Uh-oh, don't murmur, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. The people murmured against Moses and said, why is it that you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? I mean, do they believe this? Is that really what they thought? You know, God's miraculously destroyed Egypt. He's miraculously brought us through the Red Sea on dry ground. He's miraculously destroyed the armies of Egypt. He's miraculously made the water sweet. He's miraculously giving us manna day by day. What, to kill us? Does that make any sense? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. I mean, these people were, this was a mob. You know, mob rule, rent-a-mob. And they are ready to, you know, knock Moses' lights out. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb. You shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah, meaning temptation, and Meribah, meaning contention or provocation, because of the contention of the children of Israel, because they tempted, provoked the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" I mean, really, if I'd been God, they'd have been gone. It'd be a blast in the desert. Because, really? After everything God's done so far, they're saying, "Is the Lord among us or not? Does he care for us or not?" I mean, they just can't learn, can they? There's zero trust on their part. That's something that you and I obviously should be learning not to be like them. Now, you can see here that sometimes when you are going God's way, as they were on a journey that you know, God was going before them and directing them, so they were on the way of God, and circumstances weren't always, you know, helpful. They were going God's way, and there was no water, and earlier, no food, right? So sometimes when you and I are going God's way, it might not be, you know, terribly comfortable. It's not always easy to go God's way. But is the Lord with us or not? If he is, then it doesn't really matter. And you can see here, if you look back at verse 2, just one illustration of human nature. Verse 2, the people contended with Moses, saying, "Why have you done this?" Well, it's just, you know, human nature to blame other people. We're all at times guilty of that. "Well, it's the woman you gave me, Lord." "Well, it's the serpent, God." "Oh, it's my wife that made me do that." "That's because of my son." I mean, be careful. Very easy to deflect sometimes our own accountability and start blaming other people. They were quick to blame Moses many times, and of course, equally, you know, blame God. So that's the, I guess, the sixth provocation with the incredible statement. After all of this time, is God among us, do you think, or not? All you can say is idiots. Right, seventh test, Exodus 32, and verses, well, quite a few, but we'll start verse 1. Exodus 32. This is a bad one, and the rest weren't good, but this is getting off the charts, this one. Exodus 32, let's start verses 1 through 6. "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain," this is Mount Sinai, Moses is up there with God. These people have heard the Ten Commandments. Moses is up getting the tablets and so on. "When the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron," or some translations say against Aaron, "and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" Well, you should do. He's up the mountain with God. Is there a mystery there? "And Aaron said to them, 'Back off, guys. Settle down. Our Lord is with the boss up the mountain getting important instructions. Settle down. Back to your tents. Watch something decent on the TV for a while.'" Does he do that? "Aaron said to them, 'Well, okay then. Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and incredibly made a molded calf, a golden calf. And then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" It didn't exist an hour before. I could have brought them out of the land of Egypt. "So when Aaron saw it," I guess their acceptance and enthusiasm, "he built an altar before it. Well, I know Aaron's the high priest, but I think he's the high priest of Jehovah, not the high priest of a golden calf. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to Jehovah." Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play, which we read in 1 Corinthians 10. Now that's very polite language. The people sat down to eat and drink. I don't think it was ice cream sundaes. And rose up to play, and they weren't playing cards or chess. This was an orgy. For example, the verse 6 in the Good News Bible, but you can see this in quite a few translations, says, "The people sat down to a feast which turned into an orgy of drinking and sex." You know where they are? The foot of Mount Sinai. You know who's up Mount Sinai? Well, Moses, yes, but also Jehovah God, who only days before had said, don't make any idols, and don't commit adultery, and don't covet your neighbor's wife or husband, whatever. So these people are in a bad way, and so is Mr. Aaron, because he's, you know, supported this complete rebellion. Verses 7 through 10, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Go, get down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves.'" Seems a bit unfair. Said to Moses, "Your people." God, you know, sort of God's idea. He sent Moses to collect them. "They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people. Indeed, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, destroy them, and I'll make of you a great nation.'" Now, God's really angry here. I mean, he's been angry, I'm sure, quite a lot, but suffered long. This one is too much. Here's God there on Mount Sinai, discussing rules, behaviors, conduct, values, standards with Moses for the benefit of the people. And now they're having an orgy and worshipping, you know, a golden cow. What? So God says, "That's it, that's it. No further. Get out of the way, Moses. I'm going to blast this lot. There'll just be dust when I'm finished." And Moses pleaded with the Lord as God and said, "Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand?" I think, "Sorry, you have them back, God, they're not my people. Why should the Egyptians speak and say, 'He brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your fierce wrath," and it would have been fierce, I think, "and relent from this harm to your people." Right, "your people. Remember," and then throws another card out there, "remember Abraham, Isaac, Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, 'I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of I'll give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.' Remember them, remember your plan and purpose." Now, of course, God could have done that through Moses. He was a descendant of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but it probably would have put the plan back by a few decades or a century or two. "So the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people." So I guess thankful for Moses' intercession. And now Moses has to deal with the problem, verse 19 through 28. "So it was, as soon as he came near the camp," obviously Moses had been given a very brief summary. "Your people, Moses, have made a golden calf and are worshipping it. That's idolatry." Now, Moses doesn't know all the details yet, but when he gets down, he can see it. It's in, you know, live technicolor. "As soon as he came near the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing." That's not ballet dancing. It's not Irish dancing. These folk are naked. So Moses' anger became hot. He had a slight problem, I think, with anger, to be fair. We've all got problems. That was one of his. His anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder. He scattered it on the water and made the children of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you brought so great a sin upon them?" Because he's thinking, must have been some threat against Aaron. And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot." Aaron, you know, is he trying to sort of downplay this incident? Well, don't worry about it too much, Moses. It's sort of a little party. And they're using the statue to sort of honour God in a sort of roundabout fashion. I mean, calm down, brother. Calm down a bit. Aaron wasn't being a very good leader at this point. Later on in Deuteronomy, it says that God was about to blast Aaron into smithereens. So Moses had to intervene on Aaron's behalf. You know, Aaron doesn't seem too sharp at this point. So Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. For they said to me, 'Make us gods that shall go before us.'" That's what this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, "We do not know what has become of him.' And I said to them, 'Whoever has any gold, let them break it off.' So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and would you believe it? This calf came out." And obviously Moses wouldn't be fooled for more than a nanosecond. Or you just throw in all the gold, Aaron, and out pops a golden calf with eyes and ears and a tail and nostrils and hooves. Oh, yeah, pull the other one, bro. Now, when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, well, King James says naked, the net says running wild, and that's what it means. They're drunk. They are drunk, and they're chasing people around in the noddy. For Aaron had not restrained them to the shame among their enemies. You know, Aaron didn't do anything, not useful. Then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, "Whoever is on the Lord's side, let him come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. He said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp. Let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, every man his neighbor." So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. One imagines in practice, probably when Moses turned up and smashed the tablets and burnt the idol, maybe we'll drink of it. Probably most people sort of settled down, came to their senses, perhaps hung their heads in shame. But it looks like up to 3,000 didn't. I guess they are the ones who are the key rebels, key leaders. I guess they just refused to calm down and they kept on chasing and who knows what not. So those ones got dealt with. So you can see a lot of problems there. You know, the people became impatient. Like God's delays. Moses has been gone far too long. You know, well, why hasn't he turned up yet? Well, since he's missing, we'll do it our way. Now, we have to be careful, you and I, about not getting impatient if there are delays in God's purpose and plan. And we're not in charge. We have to remain faithful, remain patient, not impatient. Reminds me a bit of, you know, Abraham and Sarah. You know, Abraham had been promised a son of promise, but he got impatient. Sarah got impatient. Let's do our way. So you had Hagar and Ishmael and problems for generations. Impatient. So that's a lesson for us, not to be impatient. Notice how quick these people were to turn to idolatry. to worship God their way. Now, they said they were worshiping Jehovah. A feast to Jehovah is what Aaron called it. But you don't worship Jehovah your way with Easter eggs and bunny rabbits and wreaths on the door and a nice big fir tree in the corner of the room. And again, we can see here a failure of leadership on the part of Aaron. Aaron should have stood up against the people, you know, for God. But hang on, you're not doing that when I'm around. You know, I'm God's high priest. You people back down. Well, no, he caved in pretty quickly. So, quite a few lessons there sort of for us. And we can see, by the way, idolatry and immorality. Well, strangely, you know, Paul does highlight those in 1 Corinthians 10, that we, let us not engage in sexual immorality. Let us not engage in idolatry. So, seemingly, we've got to watch out for that. Okay, let's move on to the eighth test. Let's begin in Numbers 10:33. So out of Exodus into Numbers chapter 10 and verse 33. We're actually going to Numbers 11, but we need 10:33 just to set the scene. Numbers 10:33. So they've been there at Sinai for a while, and it tells us here in verse 33, so they departed from the mountain of the Lord. That's where all that took place. They were there quite a while. They departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. So all of that happened at Mount Sinai. Thousands have just died. There have been all the problems, all the lessons. They've only gone 3 days' journey here. That's another 70-odd hours. Surely, by now, all the lessons necessary have been learned, surely. Well, chapter 11 and verse 1, this is 3 days later. Now, when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. The people complained? Incredible. God's people complained despite heading towards a land flowing with milk and honey, with orchards and vineyards and plains of wheat and barley and coasts where you can, you know, fish, and where God's providing manna every day and he's providing water even from the rocks. He's giving them his covenant. The people complained? Really? Now, when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. So I guess it's probably quite serious complaints. Details aren't given to us. For the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. It's only 3 days out from the last place. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. So the people cried to Moses. Should have cried to God, really. When Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. So he called the name of the place Tabira, because of the fire of the Lord had burned among them. So they provoked God again. God's getting a bit probably less patient, and he sends his fire and it burns up a number of them. So he even named the place Burning or Tabira. Now, it just says the people complained. A couple of other translations which might bring out another detail. The Amplified translation says, and the people grumbled and deplored their hardships, and this was evil in the sight of the Lord. So it gives the impression that the people felt it was just too much. Perhaps it was now inconvenient to them. Maybe they got comfortable there at Mount Sinai, a three-day journey, and through the wilderness. It's not very comfortable, and their feet are sore. So they grumbled and deplored their hardships. The Message translation says the people fell to grumbling over their hard life. Now, nothing specific is really mentioned. Was the journey now seeming to be too long for them? Was it too arduous? Was it now inconvenient? But they were being blessed by God on their way to the promised land. Didn't they have any eyes at all on the vision? You know, their objective, their destination. What about us? Do we ever complain that it's just too hard? Do we complain about our hardships on the way to the kingdom? Do we have a lively vision of the world to come, Jesus' return, you know, peace on the earth, being together with the other saints for all eternity, seeing the Father face to face and Jesus? Do we understand what Paul said? The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Or is it all just too much? God's asking too much of me. Well, unfortunately, too many of us are too quick to grumble and to complain. And clearly, God doesn't like people complaining. Okay, ninth provocation, same chapter. And immediately, you wonder, don't you, what's wrong with these people? Other than the fact, of course, we have the same problems, but, you know, a number of them have just been burnt by fire in the camp, right? So you'd have thought by now they're going to think, uh-oh, got to tread carefully. God's just toasted quite a few of us because of our whinging and grumbling and complaining, so best behavior, boys. No. The next verse, they're at it again. So let's read verses 4 through 6. Now the mixed multitude, and now other translations use words like in English, rabble, the rabble who were with them, or the riffraff, that's in a translation, literally the riffraff. Now the mixed multitude who were among Israel yielded to intense craving. So when they came out of Egypt, there were other non-Israelites, a mixed multitude, a rabble, sort of low-life sorts, who went with them, who turned difficult here, but it spread to the others, because they said, the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving, lusting and strong desire, so that the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? So the mixed multitude, the rabble, stirred up Israel. Now we know about that this time of the year. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. There were people among God's people here who stirred them up to bad things. We can think of a parable Jesus gave about the wheat and the tares. You know, you and I have to watch the company we keep. You know, maybe we've got friends from the past, and maybe some are okay. But maybe, just perhaps, occasionally, there are some people in our lives that we'd be better to avoid if they're a mixed multitude. Spiritually, if they're a rabble, if they're leaven, because these leaven here stirred up all the people. Verse 4 was, who will give us meat to eat? They got manna, but they are sick of manna by now. We remember, Joel, do you remember the fish we ate freely in Egypt? The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. Can you just remember that? But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Well, okay, guys, but the manna is provided by God in heaven miraculously every day. And the manna, I would imagine, is probably 100% perfect nutrition. That would be my speculation. And these guys, you don't see them really saying, Moses, you know what? It'd be a great idea if God, who's given us so many blessings, could perhaps provide a bit of meat for us now and then, because that would really spice up our lives. Think he could do that? None of that. It's straight to grumble, grumble, whinge, complain, murmur. If we were only back in Egypt. To be a slave with a cucumber. A perfect life. What's the matter with these guys? verses 10 through 15. Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. You know, they're getting further and further into an area of difficulty, because at some point they should be learning, right? At some point they should be seeing the miracles and starting to rely on God as provider and accept that he's taking them to a wonderful place. And every time they do this, God must be sort of just shaking his head a bit and wondering, will they ever understand? And Moses also was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them? That you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to the fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep all over me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. Meat, 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 meat." That's all you heard all day long. Meat, meat, meat. Standing in front of Moses' tent. Meat, meat, meat. Drums going, meat, meat, meat. Because they've got an intense craving. That's the only thing I can think of now is meat, meat, more meat, gravy, meat, meat. None of this disgusting manna. Right? Verse 14, "I am not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, well, kill me here and now. If I found favor in your sight, don't let me see my wretchedness." So Moses is now getting to the point of being suicidal. Enough is enough. Take my life, God. These people have worn me out. I can't take any more. You can't really entirely blame the guy, can you? So let's pick up in verse 18, because God will have a solution. "Then you shall say to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come out of Egypt?" This was God's plan, take them out of Egypt to the promised land, promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They're not interested. All the meat, the garlics, the cucumbers, all the fish. Well, they're going to get meat every day, every meal, for a month, nothing else. And Moses said, "Hang on a second. The people whom I am among are 600,000 men and on foot. You've said I'll give them meat for a month? Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to provide enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to provide enough for them?" See, Moses is sort of thinking, how would that work? The Lord said to Moses, "Has the Lord's arm been shortened?" You know, even Moses can't quite see this. "Now you shall see whether my word will befall you or not." Let's drop down to verse 31 through 34. And of course, we can think here about, you know, how Jesus managed to feed thousands, didn't he, with a few loaves of bread, a couple of fish. God can do this. Now, verse 31, "A wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side, about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground." So here come the quail. Kentucky fried chicken? Delicious. "And the people stayed up all that day, all that night, all party time. Quail every direction, whoopee! And all the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp." Now, not quite sure where a homer is. I think it's basically a donkey load. So therefore, on the basis, these guys have got zero trust in God. If there's plenty of quail here, I'm stacking it up, boy. I'm going to get the least person at 10 donkey loads of birds. And probably some people had 50 donkey loads of quail stashed in their tent. Because you never know what gods are going to do. You know, quail today and nothing for the next 6 months. Oops. Verse 33, but while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. And he called the name of the place Kibroth Hataava, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. It looks like, reading between the lines, that when they started, they were out of control. Right? No trust in God, complete greed, and they just fell to it and were eating and stuffing themselves and eating, and I assume nobody said grace. You know, thank you, Father, for the food we're about to receive. Please bless it to our nourishment. Thank you for it in Jesus' name. I suspect none of that happened. Just gorge, 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 gobble, gobble, gobble. So God said, enough! And thousands died. And the place, Kibroth Hataava, means graves of lust. Graves of lust, or graves of coveting. Now, coveting, greed, lust can lead us to the grave. The lesson therefore is, because there's a direct link, the people who were greedy and lusted and coveted and had these powerful physical desires that they would not control, died. So, a lot of lessons there for us. I mean, they lack gratitude, well, from day one. They listened to low-life buddies and associates. They yielded to the flesh. They were greedy. They never managed to see God in their midst. Okay, let's move on to the final and 10th test, which is pretty much where we began, Numbers 13 and 23. So, Numbers 13, just a little bit of the background, Numbers 13, verse 23 through 33. They came to the valley of Eshcol, and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes. This is the 12 spies. They've been looking at the promised land. They're at the border now. And they were on the way back. And they carried it between two of them on a pole. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. So they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So they've been around the land for 40 days. They know what it looks like. Here's the story. And all the people are here for the first time at the borders, ready to move across and inherit the promised land. Fantastic. God's got them there despite all of their provocations. Now they're move over. And they told him, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Well, that sounds good. Nevertheless, it's true what God said. It's a fantastic country, like God said. It's a beautiful land, like God said. But, nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites are in the mountains. The Canaanites are down by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. So Caleb spots a problem here. These guys are talking about the difficulties, but Caleb's a man of faith. He says, no, let's go. We can do this. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people. They are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. All the people whom we saw are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." Well, hang on, this is the promised land, flowing with milk and honey. God's brought them there. God's shown them many, many miracles, and they should go. Now, Caleb says, "Let's go." You know, Caleb's a man who, you know, thinks, "Let God be true, and every man a liar. God's true. Let's go and get it." Verse 1 of chapter 14. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt. If only we had died in the wilderness.'" Oops. Shouldn't be saying that. "Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" I mean, they never got it, did they? Even at the border of the promised land, they still think they're going to be killed. They can't go on. They've got nothing but fear. They have no confidence in God. So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader, and we're going to go back to Egypt." Incredible. You're at the border of the promised land and you're saying, okay, I mean, this guy, I mean, maybe God appointed Moses, but we're not having him any longer. Going to choose our own leader. We're going back to Egypt, folks. "Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel, and Joshua, the son of Nun, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. They spoke to all the congregation, saying, 'The land we passed through to spy is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them. The Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' And all the congregation said, 'Stone them with stones.'" Here are the men of faith saying, "We got God's word. We can go." And I guess the lesson is, if you're a man of faith or a woman of faith, carnal people won't like it. "Let's stone them with stones." Now, thankfully, God intervened in that moment. Now, the glory of the Lord appeared at that point in the tabernacle meeting before all the children of Israel. Probably a bright, blazing light. And that maybe looked across and thought, "Oop, God's turned up. But leave Joshua and Caleb for now. Maybe get them later." And verse 11. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'How long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs which I performed among them? I'm going to strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I'll make of you, Moses, a nation greater.'" And God says, "That's it. That is it. It's over. It's over. They're all dead. I'll take you, Moses, and start again." Then Moses intercedes, as he's done more than one time before. Which leads us to, picking up in verse 20. "So after Moses intercedes, God says, 'I've pardoned according to your word, but truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have put me to the test now these 10 times, and have not heeded my voice.'" God's drawn the line now. "They certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it." Verse 26. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me. Say to them, As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, So I will do to you. You said you come out to die in the wilderness. That's why I brought you here. You'll have it. The carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered, according to your entire number, from 20 years old and above. So every person aged 20 and upwards will die, will not cross the border, will not see the promised land, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. You shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years, and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness, according to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days. For each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, and you shall know my rejection. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I will surely do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die. That was the 10th time they provoked God, and it was one time too many. You know, God is patient. I think we can see that. But there's a line. Now, for you and me, you know, we've all had years to learn God's ways and walk with God. And hopefully we are. I'm not saying we're not. But if we weren't, if we're just going through the motions, if we've just got a form of religion but deny the power thereof, then we have to watch out a little bit not to exhaust God's patience. You know, this is the day of salvation for you and me. You know, somebody said, it's quite a good saying, God took the people out of Egypt, but he couldn't take Egypt out of the people. For you and me, our old ways need to be banished. So there you are, 10 provocations to show us how not to behave. And you and I can learn the lessons from their experiences. We don't have to do it ourselves, suffer the pain ourselves. We can learn from their pain. You know, those things were written down, you know, for us. We can follow the better examples, perhaps, of Joshua and Caleb. And we know that most of those who started that journey did not finish it. They never did learn to trust God and walk by faith. They always walked by sight. And so as the Feast of Unleavened Bread draws to a close, let's remember the lessons of the Exodus. And where necessary, let's apply those lessons in our own lives. Okay, with that, we'll conclude the message.